This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The story goes like this. It's 2007 in San Francisco, and a couple of college friends with no jobs are desperately thinking of a way to make some money. Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia have the idea to buy a few air mattresses and rent out their living room to people struggling to find accommodation for a local conference in the city. To advertise it, they launch a website called Air Bed and Breakfast. Today, Airbnb is worth more than $80 billion. There are now over 4 million renters using the accommodation sharing platform in more than 100,000 localities around the world. Maybe in the last week of summer, you're listening to this from one of them. But it's not all happy campers. In some cities and towns, there are now campaigns targeting Airbnb owners, destroying the small key boxes outside their properties, and graffiti popping up that says, Airbnb scum. So how has Airbnb grown so big, and why might that have become a major problem for some neighbourhoods? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start in a place I used to visit as a boy, Llanberis, a small predominantly Welsh-speaking village in North Wales with just under 2,000 inhabitants and a lot of Airbnbs. Local documentary maker Fionn John is taking a look around for us.
I'm in the village of Llanberis at the foot of Yrwyddfa, also known as Mount Snowdon, the highest mountain in Wales. It's a beautiful day during the height of tourist season, the sun is shining and Snowdon looms over the village. Llanberis is a climber's paradise and a lot of those climbers and other tourists are using Airbnbs to stay in, including one family who has come up from London.
Obviously for us it's great with the dog and with the kids, you know.
I like how it's quite peaceful and it kind of takes you away from, like, you know, reality. It's not like city. And yeah, I think my dog's having the most fun because there's loads of walking, there's loads of other dogs here.
But a number of residents have been complaining about the squeezed housing market, with young people failing to get on the housing ladder due to the spike in house prices and lack of properties.
We should have been able to just buy somewhere. We both work full-time, we're both professionals. But the reality after COVID was incredible with Airbnbs.
Earlier, I met Mark as he was busy renovating his new home, where he's moved with his young son Oshan and his wife Lucy, who was born in Llanberis. But it wasn't easy to get this beautiful home.
We were part of kind of like there was a rush to buy houses, I think, in Llanberis and in North Wales and in beautiful places. We would go to view a house that had appeared on the market, we'd be the first viewers, and we'd see a house that isn't necessarily what we'd want, or, you know, it'd be expensive for what we'd want as well. And we'd phone later that day and say, you know, to try and have a second viewing, an offer, try and move, progress, kind of buying a house. And they'd say, we sold it. The fact that people were being able to buy houses over the phone from out of the area before we could even put a second viewing in or put an offer in was incredible. And several of those houses have now changed their names and they are Airbnbs. You can see the little key box outside. Their names changed from a Welsh name and they're now Airbnbs.
And Mark says the lack of housing has huge knock-on effects on the community.
You know, we know so many people from my little boy Oshan's class where the parents don't live in the village anymore. And you think that's such a huge, huge effect that people have been driven out away from the schools. And what will the next step be? Will all the schools in the area shut and will people have to go to Carnarvon or Bangor for school? So I understand there is some benefits in having more and more people here in the village, but at the same time, it's such a massive cost.
In 2021, over 700,000 people visited Llanberis, but not everyone appreciates the tourists taking over the village. One resident I spoke to said, Llanberis is slowly turning into the Macalouf of North Wales. It's an absolute disgrace that visitors are going to the chippy in thongs. And earlier this month, mysterious stickers popped up around town saying, Death to Airbnb.
Fionn John, that's one local experience. Time now to broaden out. How many of us are renting Airbnbs? How many of us are hosting them? And why do we seem to like it so much? James Kinnersley is Sales Director and UK Market Expert at AirDNA, a short-term rental analytics company, and he's speaking to us down the line from Barcelona. James Kinnersley, I've never used the Airbnb site, never tried to get on it. If I'm looking for somewhere to stay and I go on it, what do I do?
Okay, well, Airbnb is a sort of online marketplace, an interactive site which connects people who wish to rent out their property with people who are looking for accommodation in a specific, let's say, destination, city, area, or type of stay or type of property. Airbnb doesn't own properties, but it serves as a sort of intermediary, charging a commission as a broker. One can, let's say, search for a stay in location X for however many nights, and a list of options ranging from apartments to houses through to unique types of stays, such as, I don't know, tents, teepees, yachts, or cabins, or what have you.
Okay. Now, in the UK, how popular is Airbnb right now? I mean, how many listings are there for Airbnbs?
So, using the UK as a reference point, there's about 344,000 available listings as of July this year. The number of bookings are up by about 22% year on year. And again, nightly rates are up about 15% versus the same period last year.
Where in Britain has been the most popular, has been the biggest area of growth in Airbnbs?
The most popular destinations, again, are London, Cornwall, Devon, the Highlands. And outside of those principal markets, you've got the likes of Dorset, West Wales, Norfolk and the Lake District.
Are they more popular because that's where people want to go, or are they more popular because that's where Airbnbs have cropped up?
It's probably a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, London obviously has a broad appeal, but it's not necessarily a quintessential holiday destination, whereas the other locations you can think of sort of Cornwall or West Wales or Devon or what have you, sort of speak a bit more to holiday destinations. And this is the type of supply that can crop up and turn on and off, if you like. There's a flexibility element to what an Airbnb or a short-term rental can offer, in the sense that you don't have a fixed asset that has to be a hotel the whole time. You as a host can choose as and when you want to have the flexibility to provide that supply in a specific market.
Why is Airbnb a smart investment for the people who are renting out?
Broadly speaking, it's a source of extra income. This form of short-term rental provides an owner an opportunity to monetize an asset, but with greater flexibility. They can offer that asset when and however they desire. There's flexibility, low fees, a freedom to set a price of their choosing. And a property used in the holiday rental market can often generate double or triple the revenue of a conventional rental. This naturally has piqued and generated interest across the wider parts of the property market.
Okay, I'm presuming that some of these lets would have been second homes before, maybe even investment properties. So has that been a big advantage to hosts? Essentially, places that would otherwise have been sitting empty can now be monetized.
Exactly that, David. A number of lets may have previously just been the second homes, as you say, and which sat empty when the owner wasn't around. Ultimately, it's a better use of the housing. A number of owners do it kind of part-time as a way to make a bit of extra money or help pay towards a property that they use sporadically. But ultimately, that is the advantage. You can switch on and off having the flexibility of deciding how you use that asset. More importantly, historically, a lot of people didn't monetize or utilize the asset that they have, be that their house or another property. So this is a good way of generating extra income against property that you already own or live in.
Do we know what the trends are with this? Has the trend been towards multiple ownerships of Airbnbs or trend been towards small level ownerships, i.e. people owning one?
Broadly speaking, the market has become more professionalized over the years. Historically, a quarter of the market wasn't made up by professional operators. But there's still the individual single unit hosts make up the lion's share, and then those with a couple of properties make up the rest of the marketplace.
Let's look for a moment at what kind of displacements this might cause. I mean, the obvious question to ask here is, can you earn more from being an Airbnb host than you can from being a landlord with the same property?
As I mentioned, there's excellent potential to generate double or triple the revenue of a conventional rental. This is, as I said, piqued a lot of interest in how people view this side of the market. Ultimately, you have a higher nightly rate that you can charge, but usually over shorter stays. Bear in mind, you still have locations which can often be quite seasonal. So whilst you might do well over, you know, a summer period with higher rates, you might find that there's not the same potential for renting during like the winter months or the off season. So it kind of swings and roundabouts. It really depends how the asset's being used and how professional the kind of host is. If you're switching on and off to sort of make ends meet, then it's unlikely to generate more than a conventional rental. Whereas if it's a sort of specific, maybe a business or an investment property utilized for that function, then there's pretty good potential to generate decent revenue.
Right, interesting. What's the tax position with regard to it? How much can you earn before you get taxed significantly?
So the average revenue generating potential for a property in the UK is just under £30,000. These are obviously gross numbers. If the space you host on Airbnb is a second property or a property that you don't live in, you can earn up to £1,000 tax-free each year. Any rent over that amount is taxable. Rental income is just subject to sort of normal income tax, and that would obviously depend on what band you sit in.
James Kinnersley, just before we move on to talk about the problems, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about Saudi Arabia's growing global power, the one about whether we can meet the net zero challenge, and the two about Donald Trump's legal woes. So now we know about the size and scale of Airbnb, let's look at its emerging downsides and how we might go about fixing them. I'm joined by Vicky Spratt, the iPapers housing correspondent, and Dr. Nancy Holman, Associate Professor of Urban Planning at the London School of Economics. Vicky Spratt, what do we know about how Airbnb is affecting the local housing market?
Well, I think it's really important to look at Britain as a series of different housing markets. So the housing crisis is different wherever you go in the country. But in places where there is a high demand from tourists or in big cities where people come and visit for work, Airbnb has become a huge problem. It has taken homes out of the private rental market and put them into the holiday let market. Now, what that means is some of the places that I visited, let's take the Lake District, for example, that there are no homes available for affordable private rent. When I was in Windermere last year, I was looking, if I was there and I needed to rent, could I find somewhere? Absolutely not. Could I find an Airbnb? Oh, yes. And what that means is that communities are being hollowed out. In the Lake District, I spoke to several key workers who could no longer afford to live in the area. So you might be able to rent an Airbnb and go somewhere beautiful on holiday, but is there going to be anyone to make sure that the shelves in the supermarket are stacked to drive the ambulance if you get sick? Perhaps not.
Was your impression that the problem was bigger than, say, the old problem we had with second homes?
I think it's really important to distinguish between second homes and Airbnbs and holiday lets. These three things are related, but they are not the same. Second homes are a big problem. People who buy second homes are taking housing out of the local market and often contributing to house price inflation in that area, because if you want a second home somewhere, generally speaking, it signifies that it's a desirable place to live. Holiday lets are again a different thing. They are often local businesses and homes that are specifically built to be let out to tourists. And that contributes to the local economy if, big caveat, they are locally owned. Airbnb is a different thing again. Let's remember the premise of Airbnb was you can go on holiday like a local and stay in someone's home. But what has happened is not that people who, when they are away, are renting out their homes, that people who are professional Airbnb landlords are taking homes that would have once been for private rent and turning them into Airbnbs.
Nancy Holman, we've heard a lot there from Vicky, which is a very important but essentially anecdotal evidence about what's happening in areas. Is that your perception at a more Olympian level?
I think it's a really interesting thing that Vicky was saying in terms of localities being important in all of this, because Airbnb or short-term letting, Airbnb always gets the kind of rap for this, but that's because they're very successful. I think it's really important to understand that this can be a very hyper-local problem. So the research that I've been doing with colleagues is mainly in London, and you see a very different picture across the capital, with outer London boroughs not having much of a problem at all, but inner London boroughs having some really significant problems. So if you look at somewhere like Camden, so we're talking, generally speaking, Camden, Westminster, Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, those sorts of places. Camden has roughly 4,400 properties listed, and they reckon out of that, there's about 24% of those that are going over the 90-night limit that is allowed in London. Places like Westminster have entire apartment blocks where you have, out of 118 flats, all but, say, two of them being put onto short-term letting platforms. And that really is a considerably significant problem across hyper-local areas in the capital.
That's an astounding statistic. And we'll come back to the question of what you're allowed to do a little bit later. Coming back to this question about the second home situation, do you see this problem as essentially having aggravated what we were already seeing with second homes, of being, frankly, at a different scale?
Well, this is at a much different scale. The problem with this is you have a platform that is global. It is very easy to access. And so it is infinitely larger than someone being able to have a second home, because you're actually making something that is incredibly profitable, not just something that you have as a holiday home that you go to in the summer. That's a very different animal than having something where you can make extremely great profits from renting out.
So one of the things we've been talking about here, therefore, is this helps to create an additional shortage of local rented accommodation and so on. What about other knock-on effects on communities? I mean, Vicky, what are you seeing in terms of how it might alter the character of communities?
I think when a community changes because there's nowhere affordable for people to rent, what you see is that the demographic tends to be older. And there are places in this country, there's a village in Wales that now has no primary schools because no young families can afford to live there. In the Lake District, I was hearing from people who were campaigning because they were so worried that their children could not afford to live in the towns they grew up in, and that in the future there would be no young people to keep the Lake District going. Young families with children are what will keep those communities alive. And let's remember, lots of young adults are struggling to buy homes because, in relation to earnings across the country, housing is the least affordable it has been since the 1800s. Just sit with that for a moment. People need private renting. So if they're priced out of the private renting market, that's going to create a huge problem. And it is effectively a hollowing out of communities. But I would just add, we can talk about Airbnb being responsible for this. We can sort of demonize people with second homes and people who want to make a living from holiday lets. But there is a fundamental issue here that I think lays at the doorstep of the government, a failure of the government to build enough social housing and also to regulate the private rental market.
We'll come on a bit more, a bit later, to the question of how you might do that regulation. But Nancy, I mean, urban planning is your thing. And so how housing and changes in housing ownership and renting alters local communities is very much part of what you study. What do you think you're seeing?
Well, yes, I think all of the things that Vicky is saying are very important and very true. But I think something that we often don't see about the impacts on this in terms of community and kind of local democracy, and these are hidden problems, is the fact that actually if you do hollow out communities, if you do create places where out of 118 flats, only two are occupied by owner-occupiers or private renters, it actually means you have fewer people to participate in local democracy. You have fewer people who are going to planning meetings and helping to shape what they want in those communities.
Are you suggesting that one of the consequences of something like this is it creates what we might call a transience in the local community, which is, of course, it's just changing. They're a bit like what you used to call a student area, which are not in the real sense of neighbourhoods at all.
Well, sure. I mean, you're actually creating neighbourhoods of de facto hotels. And in planning terms, you would never want an entire neighbourhood to be hotels because you would have a continuously transient population, none of whom would have the right to vote, none of whom would actually be having the right to participate in what is actually happening in that neighbourhood.
Is there any suggestion that as a result of this, you would create a kind of a knock-on process in which you would gradually make these areas places that people like this, ordinary families and so on, wouldn't want to live?
Yes. The best example I can give you of this is one of the places we studied in Covent Garden. The building, again, was a building full of flats. It was a couple of hundred flats, I think probably 150. All but two or three had gone over to short-term letting. The people that were left in the building were desperately trying to get the local council to enforce the regulation of 90-night limits because this was causing them innumerable problems with nuisance and everything else. Because the regulation as set up by the government is absolutely impossible to enforce, which they had to have known it would be impossible to enforce, in the end, the people, the three people that were living in the building, gave up and they started to let out on Airbnb as well, and they left the building because it was intolerable to live there.
Vicky, are there no regulations which prohibit people from doing these short-term lettings on a long-term basis?
You're not supposed to do it long-term. In London, we have the 90-day limit, which Nancy has mentioned.
Can you just explain the 90-day limit to me?
It does what it says on the tin. In London, you're only supposed to be Airbnb-ing for 90 days of the year, but people don't adhere to that. And with holiday lets more broadly, there is little to no regulation at all.
Can I come in one moment on that as well? Because I think it's really important to understand this idea of the 90-night limit, which, as I've said, is very, very hard to enforce, if not impossible. I think maybe one, maybe two cases have been brought forward. Because this is so difficult to enforce, if you want to try, you need to hire enforcement officers. I think Westminster hired a team of 11. They are charged then to try to go out and detect where these people are breaking the 90-night limit. And even then, it's actually hard to enforce. So what we're doing as local councils is taking money that we don't already have and wasting it on trying to enforce something.
Can I ask whether something like the 90-night limit exists outside London and in many other places?
Sure. I mean, Paris, I think, has it's 120 nights. Lots of places do this, but the regulations have a lot more teeth. We have no teeth.
Vicky, let's look at the situation as it is, which, as you pointed out, is sub-ideal to a significant extent. Are there any new regulations being proposed by government to try and help out with any of this?
Yeah, I mean, they are talking about solutions. Whether they will ever implement them remains to be seen. It seems very difficult for the Department of Levelling Up Housing and Communities to do anything quickly. Take the Renters Reform Bill, for instance, that would protect people from being evicted via Section 21, which is what a lot of landlords have, I hear, been using to turn privately rented homes into holiday lets. The Conservatives promised to ban those evictions in 2019. We're still waiting for the legislation to make its way through Parliament. It's been years. But the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities are also looking into requiring Airbnb hosts or holiday let hosts to get planning permission from local councils in order to use a home for a short-term let. Now, in theory, on paper, that sounds great. But as Nancy has alluded to, local councils really struggle with enforcement.
Nancy, the obvious conclusion from a lot of what you and Vicky have been saying is that one approach would require significant licensing and policing of the licensing of short-term lets and so on. Can you take us through the arguments for and against that and how they've played out in localities?
So I think that we need to get very clear on the sort of things that are being proposed and the things that might work. A register is very different from a license. So a register would simply allow us to know, provided there was data sharing, what was going on the ground level, how many properties there were, how many nights they were being let out, etc. That would give us some knowledge. A licensing scheme, which potentially could work a lot better, would raise revenue because people would have to pay for that license for their Airbnb. We do that with houses in multiple occupation all over London. You would know, well, they would also, because they would be doing this more than likely then as a business, i.e. doing it over the 90-night limit, they would pay business rates, and that would go to the local council. At least half of it would go to the local council. What that would do is dampen down the number of people who just are doing this because it's very easy and they can make a lot of money. So a licensing scheme would be a simple stopgap that would help a bit with the problem. The other ideas, for example, using the planning system to change the use class and make people apply for planning permission to do this, is cumbersome, it's difficult, and it's not self-funding. So that is a cost to the local council to try to be able to do that because they have to have staffing and everything else. Cost time, cost money. In a place where you already have a lot of cash-strapped local authorities trying to do this, that then knocks on into the problem Vicky is talking about, because you have fewer planners to go through the large applications and to pass planning for housing. So you're actually just continuously exacerbating the problem.
Nancy, a kind of final word on this. Is it your perception that without significant changes to the housing market and housing provision overall, there is any way of tackling the kinds of problems that arise from something like Airbnb?
Well, I think because they're interlinked with the problems in the housing market overall, the key thing that we need to do is provide more truly affordable homes. That is the overall overarching kind of goal we should be aiming for. I think the truth of Airbnb is it's one nail in a coffin that is already there.
Vicky, maybe I'm showing my age here and the era into which I was brought up. But one of the things that you could argue is that just as people began to source their products, foodstuffs, etc., ethically, maybe there should be campaigns to get people to source their holidays ethically.
I don't think you're showing your age. I think that actually makes you aligned with Gen Z, David. Lots of people now want to holiday more ethically, and ecotourism, which is mindful of the environment, is a huge, huge sector. And I think increasingly, I'm 35, for full transparency, so I'm actually not that young. But amongst my peer group, and certainly when I go away, I try, if I can afford it, and sometimes it is more expensive, to stay in a locally owned hotel. And that's something I'm hearing more and more from lots of my mates. So I think this is a growing issue of awareness. And people know that if you're staying in a beautiful home in an area where there isn't enough social housing, it's probably not ethical.
Vicky Spratt there with Dr. Nancy Holman. My thanks to them and to James Kinnersley and Fionn John. And my conclusion In all but a few specific locations, Airbnb is essentially a new problem bolted on a much older one, the overall housing shortage. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Alex Pickles, Kirsteen Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker.
Hello, I'm India Raxon and I just want to quickly talk to you about witches. In this series from BBC Radio 4, simply titled Witch, I'm going to explore the meaning of the word today. It is a twisting, turning rabbit warren of a world, full of forgotten connections to land and to power, lost graves, stolen words, and indelible marks on the world. Because the story of the witch is actually the story of us all. Come and find out why on Witch with me, India Rackerson. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.